This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
It may look like your pet is just staring off into space for a few minutes, or it could fall to the ground, flail with its legs, vocalize, urinate, and defecate. You feel so helpless. You think your pet could be dying. What could have caused this? Did your neighbor poison your pet? Is it time to consider euthanasia? Your pet may be having a seizure, and my guest, Dr. Kelly Virick, a board-certified veterinary neurologist and neurosurgeon at Veterinary Neurology Center in Southern California, will help to demystify what you're seeing. She's going to chat with me today about the possible causes, treatments, and outcomes for these frightening displays of neurological activity. We'll be right back after this short break, so stay tuned. As you know, I love pets. I have two cats, and they have made my home their home. I just pay the mortgage. My bed, I got a bigger one. Why? Because the cats sleep on it. And yes, when you're sleeping with cats, you have to extricate yourself sometimes because you dare not move them. That is their space. That's all the stuff that I can live with. What I can't deal with is a messy litter box that stinks. So I use Arm & Hammer Clump & Seal. It clumps tight around the odor and destroys it for 7 days of an odor-free home. Guaranteed. I do recommend, however, that you scoop daily. But sometimes life gets in the way, because I find an odor-free home is a happy home for me and my cats. Arm & Hammer, more power to you.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Virick, thank you very much. This is such a scary situation for pet owners.
Yeah, definitely. When people come in, they're often really freaked out by what they've seen. And most often, it's not as serious or as scary as it looks.
So people oftentimes throw around terms, you know, seizures, convulsions, fits, epilepsy. Are they really all the same thing, or are they all different animals?
They're the same thing to a degree. A seizure is something that is originating in the brain. So we always kind of liken a seizure to saying it's like a cough, that if you have a cough, that it could be indicative of many different problems in the lung. And you can have a wet cough, you can have a dry cough, you can have coughs for various reasons. So seizures are kind of the same in that you can have focal seizures, which are very localized, and you know, maybe they do just stare off a little bit. They get a little bit of a twitch in the muzzle or a twitch in a limb. And you can have those big generalized seizures where they're on the ground and they're paddling and jaw chomping and they lose consciousness, and sometimes they urinate, sometimes they defecate. But it's all a symptom of something that's coming from the brain.
And do cats and dogs both have seizures at equal frequency?
No, they do not. Cats don't have seizures as often as dogs, particularly what we think is genetic epilepsy. There is thought that cats have a form of genetic epilepsy, but it's certainly not as well studied as it is in dogs, and we definitely see it more frequently in dogs.
And you were describing the way that seizures can look so different. You know, a pet that's just staring off into space, or what we think of the grand mal seizure, is one worse than the other? So is it better to have, you know, lots of these little itty bitty petite mal or just tremors, or is it much more detrimental to the body to have one of these major motor seizures?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question and a really complex question, because as far as the body is concerned, a generalized seizure is going to be harder on the body because we kind of liken it to running a marathon on your side. You're down, all of your muscles are active, your body temperature starts to go up, your glucose stores start to go down. So really long generalized seizures can become a problem. But the reason I say it's complicated is because these little focal seizures, while they may not be as hard on the body, they're often indicative of another problem, where generalized seizures are more typical of our run-of-the-mill genetic epilepsy that doesn't have another underlying cause. When we see more focal seizures, we start thinking about, could this be from something else? Could this be because of an electrolyte problem, a toxin, potentially a brain tumor, a stroke? So it usually leads us down a different path. So it is a little bit more of a complicated question, but in and of itself, the generalized seizures are going to be a little bit harder on the body than those focal ones.
I know so many of my pet owners that come in and they're, as you said, panicked. They've just seen this, you know, they had been oftentimes watching TV, their pet laying next to them or their pet was in the other room and they heard this kerfuffle going on. It's like, what is it? And they go in to find their pet paddling. It's like, oh my goodness. And, you know, they run in, they're still in their pajamas and their pet's in their hands. And by that time, the pet's going, hi, nice to see you. Why am I here? One of the questions they always want to know, are these seizures painful?
Yeah, that is a very common question. And no, I don't think they're painful, particularly because when they're having them, they're not conscious. However, when they come out of them, they can sometimes be a little bit sore because, again, it's like a big exercise on the side of your body. So you can have some muscle soreness if you happen to, you know, hit a table, or if you injure yourself in the middle of a seizure, there can be painful things that can happen as a result of the seizure. But the seizure itself is generally not painful.
It's interesting because one of the analogies I will always use, or explanations I'll use to pet owners, say it's not painful, typically, again, unless, of course, they tumble down a flight of stairs or something in the middle of it. And they look at me like, how do you know? I said, well, we can talk to people who have seizures and they will say they're not painful. They may feel a little bit weird going into it and kind of spacey afterwards, but during it, it's like, nope, not so much.
Right.
In the introduction, I was mentioning these, you know, gee, you always wonder, did my neighbor poison my pet? Is that what caused it? What are some of the common seizure triggers? Because I'll tell people it can be due to something inside of the brain simplistically or something outside the brain. So how does an expert explain it?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So we break up seizures into four categories. So we have the genetic seizures, the genetic epilepsy, which we used to call idiopathic, but we're finding that there's more of a genetic component to that. So we're changing the terminology a bit. And that's just our run-of-the-mill epilepsy, which we can get a little bit more into later on. And then we have the structural epilepsy, which is going to describe something that's happening in the brain. So structurally affecting the brain, which would be things like potential tumors, meningitis or inflammation in the brain, encephalitis, inflammation in the brain, strokes that can affect the brain. So most of the time in dogs, we're going to be dealing with what we call ischemic stroke. So they're going to throw blood clots and lose blood supply rather than bleeding into their brain. But that's something else that would be considered structural because it's actually affecting the brain tissue. Then we have our metabolic or reactive seizures, which are going to be things that happen outside of the brain that affect the brain. So things like changes in calcium, low blood glucose, liver disease, other things that can build up toxins or affect the neurons that then can cause a seizure. And then lastly, we have the category that we call undetermined or cryptogenic. So these are going to be the guys that don't quite meet the criteria for genetic epilepsy. They're too old or they're the wrong breed or something that we would not expect for that. But we can't find anything structurally or metabolically that's causing the seizures. So maybe it's a late onset epilepsy. Maybe there was something else happening that we missed or we didn't see. And we call those guys, like I said, undetermined or cryptogenic.
That's going to be my new favorite word. My previous favorite word was idiopathic, because I always tell people I feel like such an idiot because I can't give you the reason why it happened. But now cryptogenic, oh, that's even a better word. So
I agree. I love that word. I agree.
With people, I know that people that have seizures, many times they will have service dogs that can sense when their owners are about to have a seizure, warn them, they'll sit down, whatever, stop driving. Do they have seizure detecting dogs for dogs, or can people tell when their dogs are about to have a seizure?
Yeah, you know, not as far as I know, but I have heard families describe other dogs in the household starting to react oddly toward the epileptic dog when they're going to have a seizure. So maybe there are some initial signs there just with the other dogs in the home. I haven't heard of anybody having a seizure-detecting dog for their epileptic dog, but maybe it exists. And then there are people that can see what we consider like an aura or the prodrome of the seizure, where they maybe do something. They become a little bit more clingy. They go to a certain area of the house. There's something that they do that most often precedes their seizures. And so sometimes there are signs that would say maybe he is about to have a seizure. It's not always 100%, but we do sometimes see that.
I know so many of my pet parents are so worried after their pet has started to have seizures, going, well, how am I supposed to go out to dinner or to work or do whatever? I need to be home for my pet. You know, how do I know if it's had a seizure? So you were talking about these auras, the pre-ictal, the fancy term for what happens before a seizure, the ictal during the seizure. They may just stare off into space, flail, paddle with their feet. But what does post-ictal look like, and why is it important for a pet owner to really try to stay cognizant of what it looks like and how long it lasts?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So the post-ictal period is very variable from dog to dog. So I have some patients with seizures that pop up right away and they're almost back to normal within minutes. There are other dogs that their post-ictal phase can last hours, sometimes even days. The longest expectation for a post-ictal period with severe seizures, so meaning cluster seizures or very long and violent seizures, can be up to 7 days. And what we see in that post-ictal period can be things like changes in their mentation, where they're more lethargic, they're more disoriented. Sometimes they're more agitated, and you have to be careful if you have a pet that becomes more agitated, because they can become aggressive and they can bite. Even if they're normally the sweetest dog and they would never do that, their brain chemistry is a bit off. So there are dogs that you need to be a little bit more careful with. Sometimes you'll also see them look a bit ataxic or uncoordinated. So that's where the brain's not quite telling the feet where to go. So they cross and they maybe stumble a little bit. So there are various things that you can see there. Every dog's a little bit different, but they're just off a bit.
So we've seen the movies, we've, you know, had the urban legends that if a person starts to have a seizure, they're going to possibly swallow their tongue. You should put a rag in their mouth. You should put a wooden spoon in their mouth, something so they don't swallow their tongue.
Yeah, no, that's a myth.
Worried about dogs.
Yeah, I know it. And I'm not entirely sure where that came from, but that is definitely a myth. And we always tell people stay away from their mouth. You will get bit. What we will tell people is, again, you know, if they're by the stairs, if they're by a pool, by a sharp coffee table, you can move them a little bit, but leave them alone. Otherwise, let them lay on their side. Don't try to move them. Don't try to pick them up. And certainly don't try to put your hands in their mouth, especially when their jaws are clenched or they're doing that gum chewing, you know, where their mouth is opening and closing rapidly. You will get injured and they will not swallow their tongue.
So I know so many of my clients with especially small pets, the first thing I want to do is pick it up and snuggle it and hold it and try to comfort it. That pet is not aware of what's going on around them and they're just putting themselves in harm's way. So I totally agree with you. Don't pick it up. Just make sure that nothing can fall on it, that the pet can't tumble downstairs or fall off the bed. Do something, but don't pick it up. Don't touch it. Don't get near their mouth.
Right.
If you think your pet, you've never seen a seizure before, you've listened to this podcast going, huh, that's interesting. That's never happened to my dog. But now all of a sudden, oh my goodness, it happened. What do they do after the seizure?
Yeah. So after the seizure, you just, again, want to keep your dog safe. So if they're in that post-ictal phase and they're disoriented, sometimes they can even be blind. So they'll start bumping into things. And again, they can fall down the stairs. They can hurt themselves. So get them to a safe area and call your veterinarian. Most of the time with one seizure, we don't necessarily consider it an emergency. We don't have to rush them in. Most of the time, they're going to come out of it just fine. And we can get them in, you know, within a day or so and make sure that everything is okay. If they continue to have seizures, so then if there is another one that follows up to that one, then we definitely want to get them in, check that blood work, make sure that we're, you know, we're not missing anything there.
I'm glad you mentioned the blood work because, yes, I will say most likely, you know, if you have a younger pet, otherwise seems healthy, it could very easily be one of these idiopathic or cryptogenic seizures. But what I'd like to do is get a baseline. What's going on internally? Make sure we're not missing something. And when it comes back normal, great. We all do the happy dance and say, just keep an eye on it. But what if it has a seizure while I'm at work? What do I do?
Yeah, and most of the time, again, as long as they're short seizures, and most are, by far and away, most seizures are going to be less than 2 to 3 minutes, and they're going to be just fine. So it's okay if it happens while you're at work. Everybody, you know, most people, I guess, work. So we get asked that question a lot by people who are bringing in dogs that have known seizures, that have known epilepsy, and they're really afraid to leave the house. But most of the time, it's perfectly fine. The other thing to keep in mind is that most seizures are going to happen on a resting brain. So seizures by and large are going to happen late at night or early in the morning. So it's relatively uncommon that they're having seizures mid-afternoon. It can happen, but it's not as common as happening when you're home in the middle of the night.
That's very good to know. Well, all these good things that I'm learning right now from Dr. Kelly Virk, board-certified veterinary neurologist, diplomat at the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine. We're going to be taking a short break, come right back, and talk about some of the possible causes of epilepsy and then treating. We'll be right back after the short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
If you're attacked by a bear, a dog will throw himself into the mouth of a bear to save you. Dogs are dogs. They pour out their love onto you. Before long, you can't live without them. I have a chocolate cocker spaniel named Lady and a black mouth cur. He's about 120 pounds, and his name is Arlo. My little cocker, her coat's as soft as a stuffed animal. They're both real soft coats, and my dogs don't have any health problems because they're eating what they need to eat.
DINOVITE.com.
Dynavite is like pouring a multivitamin right onto their food.
The omega-3 fatty acids,
flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa,
the digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
We'll be scooping our Dynavite onto the food, then squirting the Lickit Chops and the fish oil. They start salivating.
Dynavite is nutrition.
You won't believe how happy your dog will be.
It's a lot of responsibility owning a dog. I get my Dynavite at DINOVITE.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
So, Dr. Virk, we have a pet who's had a seizure, trying to figure out what could be causing it. You mentioned sometimes we just can't. So how does someone such as yourself go about determining the cause, if possible?
Yeah, so we usually start with a very detailed discussion with the owner. So we're looking at things like the signalment of the patient. So what is the breed? What is the age? When did the seizure start? Some of those things can tip us off to things like the genetic form of epilepsy. So if we have, you know, a 3-year-old border collie, young sporting breed, which are going to be our more common breeds for genetic epilepsy, between 1 and 5 years of age, started having seizures, you know, within that 1 to 5 years of age, and otherwise normal in between seizures, that's often enough to say it's most likely a genetic form of epilepsy. From there, we have a discussion of how much further do we want to go in terms of making sure that we're not missing something else. So looking at the structural and metabolic causes, checking blood work, checking MRIs, et cetera. However, when we have other dogs, so you look at a signalment of a 12-year-old Yorkie, which is not going to be a typical breed for genetic epilepsy, you do start thinking about other things. So you get more of a history from the owner. Is it just seizures at home, or are they also having behavior changes, mentation changes? Do you notice that they're circling or pacing or head pressing where they're standing in corners and they just seem confused? Those things can help us to see, you know, is it more related to one area of the brain or another? And even when those signs aren't there, it'll often still push us in a direction to start to look for other possibilities. Then we move into how to look for those possibilities. So starting with the metabolic or reactive seizures, is it possible that they could be getting into something? So you mentioned toxins before, and toxins certainly can cause seizures. But when we have recurrent seizures, unless they're recurrently getting or, you know, often getting into the same toxin, it's not going to be common. So it's possible for a short, you know, seizure episode, but not for long term over months if they're continuing to have them. So then we're looking at checking blood work, check the glucose, the calcium, the sodium, the liver enzyme values, the things that we know can potentially disrupt the brain and cause seizures. If those come back normal, then we start looking into the structural category of things that can cause seizures. And that's going to push us into MRI, possible spinal taps, to see is there inflammation in the brain like that meningitis or encephalitis? Could there potentially be a brain tumor? Could there potentially be strokes? Could there be something else that's developing in the brain? There are also structural forms of epilepsy that can happen in very, very young dogs. So those are going to be things that they're born with, like hydrocephalus, which is colloquially called water on the brain. So they get big ventricles that are holding that spinal fluid that's putting pressure on the brain that can then cause seizures. So there's a host of things that can cause it. And it really comes down to looking at the signalment, what is the dog doing in between the seizures, and then starting to do diagnostic tests to work them up.
So you've done all this testing, and it sounds like it could be expensive. And some of our clients, some of the people listening right now, are going to be living in areas where, yes, they have access to someone such as yourself who can do the MRIs and CAT scans. And I'm sure some of the pet parents are listening right now going, a CAT scan on a dog? This must be extremely expensive. And what if they don't have it in their hometown? What are their options?
Yeah. So in those cases, we'll often say we treat for the treatable. And, you know, I know that that sounds crude, but that's what we'll do. And so again, we look at the dog and the age and the breed. And so, you know, as an example, in a 5-year-old Maltese, meningitis is going to be far more common than genetic epilepsy. It's just not a breed that we really see for that. So if we have like a 5-year-old Maltese that's starting to have seizures, also has other changes in between those seizures, maybe has some changes on their neurological exam, we're probably going to treat them as a suspected meningitis. So we'll put them on, you know, high dose steroids, sometimes other immunosuppressant drugs, maybe antibiotics just to cover our bases. But most often meningitis is going to be immune mediated in dogs. So their own immune system is causing that inflammation. But we treat for the treatable, you know, and we don't know what it is. We don't know how well it'll work. And we have a long conversation with the owners about that. But we'll do our best. We'll try to treat the disease. And then, of course, we're looking at the anti-seizure drugs to help control those seizures as well.
I think the other thing that's also important for the pet owner to remember is that, yes, if their veterinarian may not have the expertise or access to these neurological centers, thankfully, experts such as yourself, you are always so generous with your time to get on the phone with your veterinary colleagues and saying, okay, this is what I'm seeing, Dr. Virk. What do I need to think about? What can I do? My client can't afford an MRI. We don't have access to it. You know, what are my options? So having experts such as yourself is so, so helpful. But then also, depending on where they live, they may have access to some of the veterinary colleges and the teaching hospitals, and many of those testing equipment is available there.
Right. And we do. We encourage our local veterinarians to call us with questions, that it's not a problem. We'll pick up the phone. If you have a case that, you know, for whatever reason, they can't make it down, they don't want to come down, but you want to pick our brain a little bit, we're always available to answer questions. And I know that's true at the university level as well. You know, when I was in my residency, I spent a lot of time answering questions over the phone. So we're always available to help with stuff like that.
Thank you. That's very generous and it's extremely helpful. So you were mentioning a little bit about treating epilepsy. Maybe it's one of these genetic forms. Maybe it's something they can do no more. It's idiopathic. What are the various treatment modalities for epilepsy?
Yeah, so epilepsy, we're really looking at the anticonvulsant drugs, the anti-seizure drugs. Deciding when to put them on those drugs is, again, a conversation with the owners. If we have a dog that's having a seizure every 6 months, we may just continue to watch them for a while. We generally don't treat after a single seizure because they may never have another one. Maybe that seizure happened for some unknown reason and it'll never happen again. So it's a discussion of, you know, when is it time to really start those drugs? Generally speaking, and I think every neurologist is going to be a little bit different in this, but I usually start really pushing for anti-seizure drugs when they're having seizures every 4 to 8 weeks. So when it's happening, you know, a seizure every 2 months or so, then we'll start thinking about the anti-seizure drugs. With those drugs, we have several options. So there's the old granddaddy drugs, the phenobarbital and the potassium bromide, which are both very, very good medications. They're very strong. They really work well to control seizures. And I would say in the dogs that we're having difficulty controlling or that have very severe seizures, most often we're going straight for that phenobarbital. The downside of those is that they do have more side effects. So we see, you know, in almost every dog, we're going to see the increased thirst, increased urination, increased appetite, some lethargy, some ataxia, that incoordination or that wobbly gait. Oftentimes that gets better as they adjust to the medication, but we're going to see those things. And sometimes they can have more severe side effects. So with the phenobarbital, we have to be very careful in monitoring their blood level, because if that gets too high, then we start to worry about their liver. It can cause liver toxicity at high levels. When we check those blood levels, we often also check their CBC, the red and white blood cell count, because it can, again, very rarely, but it can cause bone marrow suppression. So it can make those red and white blood cell counts go down. So we do want to keep an eye on those things. And those are, again, conversations that we have with the owners when we start getting on those medications. Then we have the newer medications, which are primarily going to be zanisamide and levetiracetam, or also called Keppra. And neither of these, or both of these rather, don't have as many side effects as the others, but they might not be quite as effective. So in the dog that's having a seizure every 2 months, I think it's reasonable to start with these other medications, with the Keppra or with the zanisamide. But in these guys that are coming in and had 5 seizures in 1 day, most often we're jumping straight for the phenobarbital.
And even if a pet is on anti-seizure medication, and this is where I really need to hammer this in with clients, they may still have a breakthrough seizure even while on medication. How do you know when you have to say, this just isn't working, this medication's not working?
Yeah, so, and I think that I would say, rather than they may have breakthrough, they will have seizures. So we tell owners, we're not trying to resolve their seizures, we're trying to reduce them. So we consider a success on anti-seizure drugs a 50% reduction in their seizure frequency. So if we have a dog that's having, you know, a seizure a month, and we get out to having a seizure every 2 months, then we're happy with that. Or a seizure every 6 weeks, you know, we consider that success. And again, it's a conversation. If the owners are not happy with that and they want to try to get out longer, maybe we try to increase meds. Maybe we try to add in some other things. And you know, we try to find a balance between the side effects of the medication and the quality of life and controlling those seizures. Now, when the medications don't seem to be working, so let's say we start a medication and it works for a little while, and then the seizures start coming back and the frequency is increasing again. Most often, we'll try to maximize that medication before we start adding on others. So if we're starting on a low-dose phenobarbital, we'll check their level. We'll increase until we get to a higher level, not high enough to worry about the liver, but a higher level where it's still therapeutic, but maybe going to work better. If we're getting up to those higher levels and they're still having frequent seizures, then we'll usually add on medications. It's pretty rare that we'll stop medications and exchange them for others. We're usually, they're having an additive effect because these drugs work synergistically together. They really work well together. So in most cases, we're putting on multiple drugs if they're not responding.
With epilepsy, I know there are times, because people also are sadly affected with this disease, that there are times where they need neurosurgery. Is neurosurgery ever done for dogs or cats with seizure epilepsies?
Not with genetic epilepsy. So in humans, they'll talk about finding the seizure focus, ablating the seizure focus. And that's not something that we are at this point sophisticated enough to do, in all honesty, that there's a lot that goes into doing that with functional MRIs, EEGs, to find that seizure focus and then to, you know, in surgery, ablate it. I worked with an epileptology group for a little while, and they were describing when they do go into surgery in some of these patients, they have a huge host of people that go in and are involved in this surgery, including the radiologist, the epileptologist running the EEG during the surgery, the surgeon, specialized anesthesiologist. There's a lot that goes into it. So no, we're not quite to that point in dogs and cats. However, in animals with brain tumors, particularly cats, we will sometimes do surgery to remove those tumors. In cats with meningiomas, a certain type of brain tumor, surgery is considered all but curative. So we will often recommend, you know, if it's in an area that we can get to surgically, that we go in and try to take that out. Sometimes the seizures will still persist, that there's still a damaged area of the brain, but they'll often get better and their other neurological signs will get better. So their quality of life will improve if we can do surgery in cases like that.
I'm sure people are thinking, how much is this going to cost? Recently, I was chatting with a parasitologist whose own Cane Corso dog had heartworm disease, and the heartworms were actually in the femoral vein in the rear leg, and they had to go in, remove these worms. They did all sorts of other things. They also had to finally do an amputation of that affected limb. And she said, you know, put it all together, it was probably about a $25,000 from beginning to end procedure, and she rescued this dog. So if a cat were to have this meningioma and you needed to go in and do surgery to remove the mass, approximately how much do you think that might cost a cat owner?
That's a good question. Probably with MRI, a couple days in the hospital, medications to go home, the surgery itself, the anesthesia, probably looking at a ballpark of around $8,000 to $10,000, maybe less.
Such a deal. That's very good. Much better than $25,000.
Much better than $25,000. We're not going to be up to $25,000.
And if it's a cure or greatly reduces, that's spectacular. So if we have a dog, we've talked about possible causes, testing, treatment. Now what's the prognosis? Because people are always so concerned their pet's having seizures. Oh my goodness, what is this going to do for this dog's longevity? Is it meaning my dog is going to die in a year? What's the effect of these medications? What's the prognosis for dogs with epilepsy?
Yeah, so for dogs with genetic epilepsy, it's actually quite variable. And being a neurologist, being in a neurology center, we seem to see the worst ones, right? So the guys that are having a seizure every couple of months, they're well controlled. They're usually staying with their family vet because they're on one medication. They're doing very well. They don't generally need to come and see us, and they can go on to live a long, normal life. Maybe they're on one medication, maybe they're on two, but they can otherwise have a great quality of life and go on to, you know, have some other problem at 15 years old that maybe takes their life another day, but not epilepsy. And then there are the guys that are very severe epileptics. And so we call those refractory epileptics, where they're on maybe 3 and 4 medications and they're still having weekly seizures or cluster seizures, where they're having more than one seizure in a day, or they're having status epilepticus, where their seizures are lasting 5 minutes and 10 minutes. And this is time where they're on the ground and they're paddling and jaw chomping and their body temperature is going up. And so they are much more severe seizures. And those guys, their prognosis is dramatically reduced. You know, we don't have great numbers to say they're going to live 1 year or 5 years or whatever that may be, but it does definitely impact quality of life. And they can sometimes go into bad clusters of seizures or status epilepticus that we can't stop. And so it's not always epilepsy is a great disease and they're going to go on to die of something another day, but it's also relatively rare. I guess not terribly rare. It's about 1/3 of dogs that end up being refractory, but it's more uncommon that we're going to have those guys that are going to be much more difficult to control, and epilepsy can take their life.
So Dr. Kelly Virk, what's the takeaway? If there were 3 main points that people should remember about convulsions, fits, seizures, whatever they want to call it, what should they remember from this conversation today?
I think the first thing to remember is just not to panic, that when you see it, try your best not to panic and try to be cognizant of the event that's happening. So if you can, try to remember what's happening during the event so that you can pass that information on to your veterinarian. What did you see? What time of day it was? How long did it last? Take a look at your watch or at your phone and try to actually time it, because a 10-second seizure can feel like it lasts 5 minutes. And it's actually really important for us to know how long that seizure actually lasted. If you can, and oftentimes people are freaking out and I don't blame them, but if you can, try to get a recording of it, because that can also be really helpful, where, you know, sometimes we look at an event and say, yep, that's a seizure. And other times we look at it and say, oh, maybe that's something else. Maybe that's vertigo. Maybe that's fainting. Maybe that's not a seizure. So we're, you know, going down the wrong path. So if you can, try to stay calm and try to gather all of that information. The second thing I think to remember is that single seizure is generally not going to be life-threatening. So, you know, call your veterinarian, try to make an appointment, get in, get your blood work done, get an examination, make sure that there's nothing else more sinister underlying that seizure. But generally speaking, a single seizure is not going to be life-threatening. So I think that while it's a scary thing to see, it's not something you need to consider euthanasia because they, you know, you've seen a seizure. Lastly, I have to think about it.
Probably give the medication if your pet's on medication.
Wow. Yes, don't definitely give the medication. It. Yeah, absolutely. Don't stop it. Don't skip doses.
and talk to your veterinarian. If you're just seeing that there's maybe some adverse side effects, don't stop and say, oh yeah, it's been off of it for about 3 months now, doc, and I'm wondering why the seizures aren't controlled. Good. All right. Well, I've been having the joy of speaking with Dr. Kelly Virk, a board-certified veterinary neurologist and neurosurgeon at Veterinary Neurology Center in Southern California. So, Dr. Kelly, thank you so much. Some really good information.
Yeah, no problem at all. It's been great chatting with you, and I hope that this really helps the people out there listening.
Good. Well, this is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week. We'll give you more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.